Coming up on Star Stuff, a step closer to predicting solar storms, counting down to the sun's magnetic field flip, and will the comet of the century be a fizzer? All that and more coming up on Star Stuff.
This is Star Stuff.
Scientists are a step closer to predicting dangerous solar storms capable of blacking out mobile phone services, satellite navigation systems, and power grids, and it's all thanks to a newly developed computer simulation model. The research, reported in the Astrophysical Journal Letters, involves mathematical models which accurately replicated a key event which triggered a coronal mass ejection in 2011. Coronal mass ejections are powerful eruptions on the surface of the Sun, capable of ejecting billions of tons of highly charged plasma into space at speeds of millions of kilometers an hour. A direct hit from one of these geomagnetic storms can deform the Earth's magnetic field, generating the spectacular northern and southern lights, the Aurora Borealis and Aurora Australis. However, they can also overload power grid transformers, causing widespread blackouts, such as at the Canadian province of Quebec in 1989. They can disrupt radio communication systems, fry delicate electronics aboard orbiting satellites, and pose a serious radiation threat to astronauts aboard the International Space Station. The research team, led by Dr. Shai Wu from the University of Alabama in Huntsville, together with colleagues from China's National Space Science Center, want to eventually develop a space weather forecasting model which will do the same job that meteorological models do for weather forecasting on Earth. Scientists think coronal mass ejections are caused by the disruption of the Sun's magnetic field. But the physical mechanism which initiates such an eruption remains a mystery because the coronal magnetic field is difficult to measure. Consequently, previous numerical simulations for the initiation process for coronal mass ejections have mostly been developed using idealized magnetic field models. Using a new generation of spacecraft observations as a guide, Wu and colleagues painstakingly combined two different modeling methods, a field extrapolation method and a time-dependent numerical magnetohydrodynamic model. They then successfully reproduced a mathematical model of an actual developing sunspot named AR1128-3, which occurred on the Sun's surface on September 6, 2011. The hotspot eventually generated at least two solar flares and a powerful coronal mass ejection, which hit the Earth 2 days later. A careful examination of this pre-eruption field revealed a sigmoid, an S-shaped coronal loop consisting of a magnetic flux rope. The overlying field of the sigmoid contained a magnetic null point, a neutral area where the coronal magnetic field strength was zero. The authors believe magnetic reconnection, in which magnetic field lines break apart and then reconnect releasing energy, occur at these null points, cutting overlying tethers of the sigmoidal flux rope and triggering the coronal mass ejection. From the numerical simulation results, the authors could see a close resemblance to the actual remote sensing data taken during the September 6 eruption. One of the paper's fellow authors, University of Alabama Assistant Professor Chiang Hu, says the simulation is the first of its kind.
So what we achieved was really a so-called self-consistent simulation of the real eruption. So from the simulation result, numerical result, we can see a close resemblance to the actual remote sensing images of the eruption.
And this is the first time that's been done, isn't it?
We believe so.
That's Dr. Chiang Hu from the University of Alabama in Huntsville. The Sun is currently at solar max, the climax of its 11-year solar cycle, and according to NASA's latest measurements, the big moment when the Sun's vast magnetic field flips over is about to happen. Right now, the Sun's two hemispheres are out of sync. The solar north pole has already changed polarity, and the south pole is racing to catch up. Scientists say a complete pole reversal, which will have ripple effects throughout the solar system, can be no more than 3 to 4 months away. The Sun's magnetic field changes polarity approximately every 11 years. It happens at the peak of each solar cycle as the Sun's inner magnetic dynamo reorganizes itself. The coming reversal will mark the midpoint of solar cycle 24. As the poles flip, the Sun's polar magnetic field weakens, going down to zero. It'll then emerge again, but with an opposite polarity. North Pole will become South, and South Pole will be North. This is a regular part of the solar cycle. Of course, a reversal in the Sun's magnetic field is, well, quite literally a huge event. The domain of the Sun's magnetic influence, after all, the heliosphere, encompasses the entire solar system, extending well beyond Pluto. In fact, the changes in polarity will ripple all the way out to where the Voyager probes are now, at the very doorstep of interstellar space. When solar physicists talk about solar field reversals, their conversations often center around something called the current sheet. This current sheet is a sprawling surface jutting outwards from the Sun's equator, where the Sun's slowly rotating magnetic field induces an electric current. Now, the current itself is small, only 1/10 billionth of an amp per square meter. But there's an awful lot of it. In fact, the amperage flows through a region 10,000 kilometers thick and literally billions of kilometers wide. Electrically speaking, the entire heliosphere is organized around this enormous sheet. During field reversals, the current sheet becomes very wavy. As Earth orbits the Sun, the planet dips in and out of the current sheet. Transitions from one side to the other can stir up stormy space weather around the planet. And cosmic rays from outside our solar system are also affected. These high-energy particles are accelerated to nearly the speed of light by supernova explosions and other violent events throughout the galaxy. Cosmic rays are a danger to astronauts and space probes, and some researchers think they may affect the cloudiness and climate on Earth as well. The current sheet acts as a barrier to cosmic rays, deflecting them as they attempt to penetrate the inner solar system. A wavy, crinkly sheet acts as a better shield against these energetic particles from deep space. But with the Sun's magnetic field flipping, that barrier is somewhat diminished. NASA's Interface Region Imaging Spectrograph spacecraft, better known as IRIS, has achieved first light, capturing amazingly new, highly detailed images of the Sun. The new data provides the first ever detailed observations of the lowermost layers of the Sun's atmosphere, the so-called solar interface region. The images are revealing dynamic magnetic structures and flows of material in the Sun's atmosphere, and they hint at the tremendous amounts of energy transferring through this little understood region. These features may help power the Sun's dynamic million-degree atmosphere, and they could also be driving the solar wind which streams out to fill the entire solar system, buffeting Earth with geomagnetic storms, and generating the heliosphere, the outer edge of which is, as we mentioned earlier, where the Voyager spacecraft are now exploring, 18 billion kilometers away. NASA describes the new IRIS observations as opening a new window on the energetics of the Sun's atmosphere. The energy flowing through the solar interface region powers the upper layers of the Sun's atmosphere, the corona, to temperatures of over 1,000,000 degrees. That's 1,000 times hotter than the Sun's surface. So understanding the interface region is important because it drives the solar wind and forms the ultraviolet emissions which impact near-Earth space and Earth's climate. IRIS's first images show a multitude of thin, fiber-like structures that have never been seen before. The observations reveal enormous contrasts in density and temperature throughout the region, even between neighboring loops only a few hundred kilometers apart. The images are also showing spots which rapidly brighten and dim, providing clues as to how energy is transported and absorbed throughout the area. Scientists will now have to try and understand what it is they're actually seeing. NASA Ames provides mission control for IRIS and will also provide primary processing for the spacecraft data through the agency's new Pleiades supercomputer. IRIS was launched on June the 27th from the underbelly of a modified Lockheed TriStar airliner, which had taken off earlier from the Vandenberg Air Force Base in California. The spacecraft was air-launched aboard a Pegasus XL F-42 rocket, which eventually placed IRIS into a 650-kilometer-high orbit. Designed to observe the interface region more clearly than ever before, IRIS's instruments combine an ultraviolet telescope and a spectrograph. The telescope provides high-resolution images, able to resolve features down to just 250 kilometers. The spectrograph splits the Sun's light into its various wavelengths and measures how much of any given wavelength is present. Analysis of these spectral lines also provide details such as velocity, temperature and density, key information enabling scientists to track how energy and heat moves throughout the region. A new study has found that the intensity of jets of water, ice and organic particles shooting out from Saturn's ice moon Enceladus all depends on exactly how close the moon is to Saturn itself. The new findings by NASA's Cassini spacecraft adds to the growing pile of evidence that a liquid water reservoir or ocean lurks under the tiny moon's frozen surface. A report in the journal Nature claims the discovery provides the first clear observation that the plumes emanating from Enceladus' South Pole region change predictably depending on its orbital position. The study found these Enceladian jets are almost closed when the moon is near Saturn, while they're mostly open when the moon is furthest away. Scientists think it's caused by tidal forces as Saturn squeezes and then releases the moon during its orbit. Those same forces are generating heat, which keeps the water liquid. Cassini's been studying the Saturnian system since 2004, discovering the jets that form the plumes a year later. The water ice and organic particles spray out of several narrow fissures nicknamed tiger stripes. Astronomers say the way the jets react so responsively to changing stresses on Enceladus suggests they originate in a large body of liquid water. Of course, liquid water is the key to the development of life on Earth, so these discoveries, dare I say, whet the appetite of astrobiologists who want to know if life can exist on other worlds where water is liquid. If there is life under the frozen surface of Enceladus, then it would have developed independently of life here on Earth. And that would have implications for the development of life throughout the universe. For years, scientists have hypothesized that the intensity of the Enceladian jets varied over time. But no one had been able to show that they changed in a recognizable pattern. That's where Cassini came in. The spacecraft saw the changes by examining infrared data in the plumes as a whole over a long timescale. The data shows the plumes were dimmest when the moon was at perigee, its closest orbital position to Saturn. The plumes gradually brightened as Enceladus moved to its most distant orbital point, known as apogee, where the plumes were 3 to 4 times brighter than at the dimmest detection. Adding the brightness data to previous models of how Saturn squeezes Enceladus, scientists deduced the stronger gravitational squeeze near the planet reduces the opening of the tiger stripes and the amount of material spraying out. And conversely, the relaxing of Saturn's gravity further away from the planet allows the tiger stripes to be more open and for the spray to escape in larger quantities. Well, Comet Ison, the so-called comet of the century, may have already turned out to be a fizzer. In fact, astronomers are now saying the future of this comet doesn't look all that bright. New light curve observations show the comet, which is currently moving towards the Sun at 26 kilometers per second, has not brightened since mid-January. In fact, as Comet Ison gets closer to the Sun, it should be getting much brighter as the Sun's heat penetrates deeper into its core, allowing more volatiles to boil away. Scientists think the comet's weird behavior may be because it's already out of volatile material, the material which melts and boils and sublimates away as the comet moves closer to the Sun, creating its spectacular tail. Another theory is that the comet, which is covered in a thick crust, usually a layer of silicate dust, could simply snuff out the water vapor, preventing it and other gases from escaping. The comet, officially named C2012S1 ISON, ISON by the way comes from International Scientific Optical Network, that's the telescope series that discovered it, was first detected in September 2012 by two amateur Russian astronomers. It's due to pass within about 1.2 million kilometers of the Sun on November the 28th. The relative close encounter was predicted to create a massive tail that some scientists predicted would be visible even in daylight. That's if it survives its close encounter with the Sun, of course. After all, at that distance, the comet would reach temperatures of about 2,700 degrees Celsius, hot enough to melt lead. And that perihelion, or closest orbital point to the Sun, will also position it inside its Roche limit. Now, a Roche limit is where the gravitational tidal forces of the Sun should be strong enough to pull the comet apart. The simple fact is, astronomers don't know what Ison's current status is. That's because it's all hidden behind solar glare at the moment and so is unobservable. What they do know is that Ison originated in the Oort cloud, a cluster of icy rocks and debris that circles the Sun up to a light year away. Calculations show Comet Ison is making its first and possibly also its last voyage to the inner solar system. Astronomers and the general public alike will be keeping a close eye on it. Astronomers have discovered a new type of star cluster in a nearby galaxy, which is raising more questions than answers about the origins of these spectacular objects. The study, reported in the monthly notices of the Royal Astronomical Society, fills the so-called avoidance zone, a long-standing gap in the existing range of sizes and masses for these closely packed communities of stars. The study's lead author, Professor Duncan Forbes from Swinburne University in Melbourne, says the discovery will force theoreticians back to the drawing boards to try and explain how these ancient clusters are formed. The new observations present a challenge to researchers aiming to reproduce star clusters in computer simulations. Globular star clusters were first discovered in 1665, and it's taken more than 340 years for astronomers to fully appreciate all the different types of star clusters that make up the universe. This new study may have found the missing link which unifies and brings all star clusters into the one family. The new category is less massive than ultra-compact dwarf objects, which are large and very densely populated star clusters and possibly the remains of small galaxies torn apart by bigger ones. The group is, however, more massive than what are known as faint fuzzies. These are large, less dense star clusters thought to come from the merging of smaller clusters. A third group, known as globular clusters, are tight spheres of stars often over 10 billion years old and possibly made from the collapse of star-forming molecular gas clouds. Forbes says it's difficult to explain this continuous range of cluster sizes and properties by existing hypotheses. And he thinks it may involve a process scientists haven't yet thought of.
We thought that there was an area of parameter space, if you like, so the star clusters with a certain size and a certain mass were just not produced in the universe, or at least we hadn't found any.
So, and these are all globular-type clusters we're talking about, aren't they?
Yeah, similar, that's right, yeah, so star clusters. So the fact that we've now sort of filled in this gap and connected the faint fuzzies to the UCD, the ultra-compact dwarfs, it suggests that star clusters have a continuous range in their properties of size and mass so that they're not separate anymore.
And what does that tell us about how they're formed? Because before we used to think of star clusters either being the centres of galaxies that were gobbled up by larger galaxies, or alternatively that they were simply formed when a whole bunch of stars, when I say a bunch, a million or more, are all formed in the one area at the one time and they just hang around each other because of their gravitational attraction to each other.
Yeah, that's pretty much right. So you could either have sort of a bottom-up idea where things are merging to form larger objects, or a top-down where you start with a bigger object and you strip away some stars and you're left with something a bit smaller. So those are sort of the two general ideas, but it seems pretty difficult to explain now this continuous range of properties with either of those ideas themselves individually. So maybe we need a combination of the two processes operating, or maybe it's some other formation mechanism that we haven't thought of yet.
How did you make these observations? Because one of the problems with looking for this particular massive star cluster is that they were hard to find in the first place, weren't they?
Yes, that's right. So the ones that this gap, if you like, in parameter space, a certain size and luminosity meant that these objects were quite diffuse and relatively hard to find. So we've used a combination of the Hubble Space Telescope, which we looked around three nearby galaxies and we found some good candidates for these objects that would have the right sizes and masses. But what you really needed then is to be able to confirm that they were at the same distance as the giant galaxy that they orbited around. So to do that, you need a spectrum. And because they're diffuse and faint, this has been quite difficult in the past. So we went to the Keck Telescope in Hawaii, which is the world's largest, and had quite a long exposure using the Keck telescope, and we managed to get a spectrum of many of these objects and show that they were indeed at the same distance as the giant galaxy, and therefore they had the sizes and masses that filled in this gap.
So you knew how far away they were because you could confirm they were part of that galaxy, and then you could work out the overall mass by how bright the cluster looked.
Yes, essentially, that's right. So we're essentially taking the angular or apparent properties of the object and then converting them into intrinsic or absolute properties once we know, you know, once we have their distance confirmed.
And that gives you the mass, and that way you realise you had something in this middle mass range between the UCDs and the FFs. And and so now you've raised, you've caused a big headache for theoreticians.
Yeah, well, certainly some challenges. Yeah, that's right. So I think, you know, they like challenges, so we have found some more objects for them to try to reproduce, so see if their theories can do it.
These were all very red, meaning they were all fairly old, I take it.
Yes, that's right. So it did seem that the majority of them were red, although we also noticed some changes in the sense that the red objects tended to be the ones of lower mass, and then we had some bluer objects tended to be the ones of higher mass. So it might actually suggest that, you know, you do have different types of star clusters. A way of getting sort of blue colours is actually to have lower metallicity or a lower chemical abundance.
Okay. So in that case, the blue would be, if they have lower metallicity, the blue would also mean older.
Yes, that's right. It could do. Indeed. So that's one of the next steps, I guess, which would require even more telescope time, is to get a spectrum of a wide wavelength coverage, and then you could start to identify some lines in that spectrum that told you something about the abundance and the age of the object you were looking at. A dedicated survey, I think, needs to be done now now that we know that these objects exist, who'd find out what type of host galaxies they occupy. So, for example, you know, the Milky Way doesn't appear to have any of these types of objects, otherwise we would have known about them earlier. Are they just found around early-type galaxies, which include ellipticals and S-zeros, or are they found around spirals? These are the questions that we don't know yet.
Macquarie University's Dr. Lee Spittle, who was a co-author on the paper, says finding the clusters was difficult, which is why they haven't been noticed before.
People hadn't really looked in this spot before, and they kind of assumed that nothing was there. There's a kind of a big avoidance zone, as it's been called. And what we found was this new class of star cluster, things that are pretty large, but not so massive. So what we're trying to understand is, are these old star clusters, do they all come from the same type of event? You know, were they all small little dwarf galaxies that fell into the Milky Way? Or were they kind of like open clusters, just forming in large clouds of gas within the Milky Way? And so that's an important thing to do, because it's believed that most stars form in star clusters of some sort. And so by cataloging them, looking for new kinds of star clusters, you can start to map out the kind of family tree of star clusters and figure out what's going on.
I guess the next question to ask is, what does a star cluster look like?
Yeah, so the ones that we discovered are actually very far away. So they're in other galaxies, not the Milky Way. And so they are very, very faint, and they're also very, very small when you look for them. Now, in real life, they're huge. They're unbelievably large, but because they're so far away, they look like little points of light in our images. And it's almost actually very difficult to tell them apart from other things, like a star in our galaxy that also looks like a point of light, or even a galaxy that's much, much larger, but much further away. It also kind of looks like a point of light. And so you have to pick out the ones that you're interested in and isolate those and study them.
When you look at these clusters, I'm imagining something like a humongous, and I know that's a very accurate scientific term, a humongous ball of maybe a million stars all packed closely together.
That's right. Yeah, so these star clusters, they've survived a long time, and so that immediately tells you they need to be kind of tough. And star clusters that are low mass and kind of diffuse things, very spread out, they tend to be destroyed pretty quickly. And so that you're kind of looking for things that are kind of dense, like you're saying. A lot of stars packed into a small region. Anything that's not so packed won't survive, because existing in a galaxy for billions of years, you go through a lot of gravitational forces, kind of you're sloshing around orbiting the galaxy, and that can destroy them pretty easily.
That's Dr. Lee Spittle from Sydney's Macquarie University. Japan has launched a new supply ship bound for the International Space Station. The H-2B rocket blasted up from the Tanegashima Space Center 300 kilometres south of Tokyo.
T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, ignition. And liftoff. Liftoff of the HTV on a journey to the International Space Station.
H2B ロケット4号機は平成25年8月4日午前4時48分46秒に種子島宇宙センターから打ち上げられました。 We had a liftoff of the H-2B launch vehicle number 4 with the Kono 34 on board from the Tanegashima Space Center at 4:48:46 a.m. on August 4, 2013, Japan Standard Time.
And 35 seconds into the flight, and the familiar scream of the H-2B as it heads uphill.
After liftoff, the launch vehicle operation control was shifted from the blockhouse to the range control center.
ロケットは現在初期飛行方位角を 108.5 度とし、徐々に南東方向の太平洋上へ飛行しています。
The H-2B is now flying over the Pacific Ocean to the southeast with its initial flight angle of 108.5 degrees.
打ち上げ後1分が経過しました。
It's 1 minute after liftoff.
ロケットは正常に飛行中であり、種子島、内之浦の各地上局は正常にロケットの追尾を行っています。
The H-2B is flying normally, and the Tanegashima and Uchinoura stations are tracking the launch vehicle very well.
1 minute 30 seconds into the flight, all systems go.
The Japanese aerospace agency JAXA says the spacecraft will dock with the space station on Friday. After a series of spectacular early failures, the Mitsubishi-built H-2A and H-2B rockets have now been successfully launched 20 times. On board the H-2B is the HTV-4 cargo ship, loaded with supplies of drinking water, food, clothing and scientific equipment for the space station crew. Also on board is a small talking robot. The android's designed to act as a chatting companion for Japanese astronaut Kiyoshi Wakata, who's set to arrive on station later this year. Standing just 34 centimetres tall and weighing about a kilogram, the black and white robot, which wears bright red boots, is named Kirobo. It's programmed to communicate in Japanese and keep records of conversations with Wakata, who will be the first Japanese astronaut to command the International Space Station. It'll become the second robot aboard the orbiting outpost, joining the General Motors-built Robonaut 2, or R2, which flew aboard the Space Shuttle Discovery on STS-133 back in February 2011. Also aboard the flight were the first pair of Arusat nanosatellites. The 10-centimetre cube-shaped satellites weigh about a kilogram each and are powered by solar panels feeding rechargeable batteries. Inside are a number of instruments including cameras, temperature sensors, carbon dioxide and ozone sensors, and a Geiger counter. There's also an instrument that can measure radio signals from meteors entering the Earth's atmosphere. The satellites use sun sensors, gyroscopes and GPS receivers to work out their exact position in space. The satellites will be deployed in orbit by the space station's robotic canard arm too. Once in orbit, they'll perform a series of tests to self-stabilize. They'll then begin accepting experiments designed and uploaded by school kids. And that's the show for now. If you've missed part of it on the radio or you want to hear the show again, don't forget Star Stuff's available as a weekly podcast at abc.net.au/science/starstuff. The Star Stuff blog's always packed full of the latest news, spectacular images, stuff I find amusing, and heaps of other media we simply couldn't fit in the show. You can find it all at abcstarstuff.tumblr.com. That's all one word and in lowercase, and that's Tumblr without the E. And there's our ABC Star Stuff Twitter feed for the latest developments in astronomy, space sciences and cosmology as they happen. We give you current news, information, ongoing updates and cool URLs. Just Google in the at symbol, followed by ABC Star Stuff, all as one word in lowercase, and we'll keep you informed. And for the latest news in science and technology, go to the ABC Science website at abc.net.au/science.